This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and today I have one of the most recognizable voices in the alternative media right here in the studio with me, the one and only Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Amy Goodman, welcome to Progressive Radio.
It's great to be with you, Matt, and a real honor to be here doing something with the Progressive magazine, such an important magazine and publication in this country, and especially now so needed.
Oh, you're too kind. Listen, it is a really dicey political moment, though, and I'm wondering what is your assessment of it? We're talking now after Bush's State of the Union, and with the war seemingly imminent any week now, do you think there's any possibility that Bush won't go to war?
Well, I will not say that the war is inevitable. And I think the fact that Bush has not engaged in a full-scale invasion of Iraq to this point is because of the peace movement and the outcry around the world. And even if he does begin invasion, of course, he's been bombing for a long time, as Clinton was before him and Bush did before him. Even if it does happen, the peace movement plays an absolutely critical role in determining how long it goes on for, how many people will live, and how many people will die.
Have you been surprised by the size or intensity of the peace movement?
No, it doesn't surprise me. We've been chronicling this for a long time. I mean, there are millions of people around the world who are deeply opposed to this. And in this country, all the polls show now, which is why I think the media doesn't emphasize polls very much right now, that most Americans, including Republicans, are opposed to war.
I mean, the numbers are almost 2-1 when asked, should the United States essentially go it alone? 2-1 against. Only when the question is asked, should the United States go with the approval of the United Nations, does there get to be a majority in favor of the war, at least according to the polls I'm seeing. And yet you have the sense from Bush that he just doesn't really care one bit what anyone says, what the United Nations says, or any of the allies.
Well, why should he care? I mean, this is a man who was not democratically elected president. So what does he care about what the people of this country think?
He seems to think he's inherited the throne in a way. I mean, he does have this kind of boy emperor style to him, don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, you know, here is a person who on Martin Luther King's birthday announces that he'll be the Bush administration will be filing a brief with the Supreme Court against affirmative action. And you look at him. I mean, look at George Bush and how he got to where he is, the greatest and most powerful affirmative action program of all for wealthy white men who are part of powerful political families. How do you think he got into Yale? I mean, he had a C average, for God's sakes.
But that all seems lost on him. I mean, he can talk out of both sides of his mouth. He does it all the time. He says, you know, he's for diversity, but he's against affirmative action. You know, he's for health care for all, but he wants to privatize Medicare. I mean, it's cognitive dissonance if you're listening, but it doesn't seem to register with him.
Not with him, but with everyone else. And the one thing I think he is succeeding in doing is uniting people across the political spectrum. You've got people on the right who are deeply concerned and, you know, what those who call themselves conservatives, deeply concerned about issues of privacy, issues of corporate corruption and the peace movement, the anti-corporate globalization movement. Everyone is joining together. He's uniting a lot of forces. And, you know, these polls that you say, Matt, show overwhelming number of people here are opposed to war. And then you look at, well, but if, you know, there are other countries who will go along with Bush. I don't doubt he can get these other countries in the United Nations Security Council, even the UN Security Council, even France and Germany when push comes to shove. But that's the leaders. That's not the people of those countries.
Some polls in Italy, in Germany, even in Great Britain show 75-80% opposed to the war. Same with Turkey, 83%.
Right. I mean, Spain, one of the eight countries now that is trying to pressure France and Germany to toe the line, the vast majority of people in Spain are opposed to war. And in Italy, I mean, you have Berlusconi happens to be in town now, the man who owns all the press, and the press here basically, I wonder how different it would be if it was owned by Bush. I don't think it would be that different than what we're seeing right now. But, you know, these guys do not represent their populations. And again, I don't think anything is inevitable. I think that those who are opposed to war right now are making George Bush and his cohorts, the oligarchy, Cheney, the former head of the largest oil services corporation in the world, Halliburton, which is benefiting handsomely around the world right now.
And evidently may take over the oil fields or reconstruct the oil fields.
Right, so. And then the companies will benefit from them, like Condoleezza Rice's Chevron. She was on the board of directors there for many years, and Chevron, one of those four or five oil companies that will make their killing in Iraq, along with...
I'm sorry, Amy. Amy Goodman, to what extent do you think oil is the underlying and overwhelming factor here, or are there other factors at play?
Oh, I mean, I think there are a number of factors, but I think oil is a very important one. And it's extremely important to say that because of how little it's said in the media, to really emphasize that. I think Charlie Rose was interviewing Gore Vidal the other day. And he's asked him what he thought about the war, and that he better not say that the answer is oil. And how quickly I was recently on CNN. The minute I said oil, the person I was on against immediately said, "That's absurd. That's absurd."
You know, I read that transcript on Democracy Now!'s webpage. You were on with Wolf Blitzer, and then someone from the Council on Foreign Relations, and the guy was in so total. In such total denial about oil, or as if you had said an obscenity.
Yeah, that three-letter word, which for the world has become one, really, when you think about the effects of it, from SUVs to war and what it's doing. Look at the oil companies in the world that will benefit from this. British Petroleum in Britain, Chevron, Shell, ExxonMobil, four of the five biggest companies, they're bigger than countries. Four of the five biggest companies are from the two countries that are continually bombing Iraq in the north and the south, the no-fly zones. And it's no accident that Britain and the United States are leading the spearheading the move to invade Iraq. They want to, and they're unapologetic about this, they want to control the oil fields. It's very clear, and it's very important we say it. There are other factors that have to do with empire and revenge, but oil is, I think, the main motivating one.
You do that CNN thing. How often do you get to go on the mainstream media and talk about this kind of radical politics?
Not that often. But I think there's an opening now because there is such an overwhelming opposition movement right now that the media cannot deny it.
They were ignoring it or neglecting it through last fall, but now it seems to have gotten to such a size that they can't really say it's not happening.
Right, and I think something important has shifted, and that is that people are seeing the media institutions as a part. It's like in Venezuela, right? The media institutions are leading the opposition to Chavez. They are key players right now in this country. I mean, you have NBC, owned by General Electric, one of the major nuclear weapons manufacturers in the world. But it's not only because they're owned by a nuclear weapons manufacturer. All the media, the mainstream media, is beating the drums for war. And people see, I mean, the silence is deafening. And they have been able to, as well as the press, go after the New York Times because of its either complete whiting out of the peace movement or total misrepresentation of it. And so hundreds, I don't know if thousands of people were calling in after the big peace march in October saying, you can no longer lie about this. What do you mean a few thousand people? We saw it on C-SPAN. We heard it on Pacifica Radio, or we were there. And it's not true. And so you have on October 29th, the Sunday after the big peace rally on Saturday, where, I mean, we were covering it, went up to the police, and they estimated more than 150,000. This was the police. They don't say it publicly because they don't estimate now after the Million Man March when they said they were less than a million. But they did say that, more than 150,000. And the New York Times says the next day, several thousand people marched. The organizers were disappointed by the turnout, even though the sun had come out. You know, this is how few there were. And then there were few protests in other cities in this country and around the world. So that could be two or three around the world. I mean, there were hundreds around the world. And I think because of the tremendous response and the fury that people felt, I think actually on NPR, I heard in San Francisco, they said it was a group of old hippies and young punks. Mm. And then on NPR in general, they said that the estimates may be around 10,000, but we think there's fewer. And then they, the reporter who was standing at the White House said she had interviewed people that said they were for a ratcheting up of sanctions against Iraq. Well, they had to apologize. And while the New York Times never actually officially issued a correction, a few days later, they just did another piece on the exact same rally. But this time they said between 100 and 200,000 people rallied, that the organizers were overwhelmed by the response. They'd only taken out a permit for 20,000. They expected 30 buses and more than 650 turned out. We called the editor of the New York Times and asked, you know, why hadn't they issued a retraction or a correction?
He said, "Well, there was
no." He said, "We didn't make a mistake." We said, "Oh, really? Well, how do you account for two articles that were diametrically opposed in their coverage?" He said, "It's just a difference of perspective."
I'm Matt Rothschild of The Progressive. I'm speaking with Amy Goodman, the co-host of Democracy Now! You know, the thing that's bothering me about the New York Times these days is the op-ed page. You can't find a coherent anti-war perspective on the op-ed page, not from their regular paid columnists. Of course, William Safire is not going to give it, but also from alternative space that's supposed to be available there. I haven't seen one bit of real estate there in that prime position in the New York Times given over to someone on the left who wants to paint the picture, the moral picture as to why this war is wrong. And it's the exact same thing that happened during the Afghan war. For 6 months, once the war started, and including the month prior, there wasn't one op-ed column there. What does that tell you?
It says that the New York Times is for war, but it doesn't say that so go the rest of the American people, because it's not true. And we just have to, not only, I think, people have to protest in front of the Pentagon and the White House and all over this country, but have to protest in front of the media houses, the big media institutions, because they are some of the most powerful corporations in the world, not only because they're among the wealthiest, but because they are the lens through which we see ourselves all too often and through which the rest of the world sees us. It's how we're projected around the world. And it's a false projection, and we have to set it right.
Now, Amy Goodman, you're one of the leading voices in the alternative media. There are two different schools of thought on the left, really, as far as the media goes. There's one school that says, let's just forget about mainstream media because it's too corporate biased and we're never going to be able to get in except maybe a word in edgewise here and there. So let's build our own media. And then there's the school that says, well, we've got to really infiltrate the mainstream media because that's where the public is. Where are you on that?
I think both. I mean, I don't think we can be categorical either way. I think we have to build an independent media movement in this country that is happening. I mean, The Progressive has been here for a long time. Then you've got the independent media, indiemedia.org, that really blossomed at the Battle of Seattle, and from there, and indie media centers all over this country and around the world covering the anti-corporate globalization movement and now the anti-war movement. Pacifica Radio there for more than 50 years. The public access TV stations. People sometimes are not as aware that in the same way that we fought back a corporate takeover of Pacifica, media activists have fought for those public spaces in television. Television is so important in how people get information. And as the AOL, Time Warner, and the other media monopolies have taken over cable, media activists have wrested a little of their space. It's our space, really, and it's the public channels that we get in every community, and we have to use them or we're going to lose them.
Now, Democracy Now!, you started to simulcast not only on radio but on TV and on some of these community access cable TV stations. When did you decide to do that, and what's the success been?
We began right around September 11th. We actually started the Republican and Democratic conventions in 2000, Juan Gonzalez, I, and the whole Democracy Now! Team, but started on a daily basis right about September 11th. At that point, we had been thrown out of WBAI in the midst of the corporate takeover, again, which we successfully, with millions of people around this country, fought back. Millions of people built Pacifica, and a lot of people fought back against the corporate takeover. But at the time we were thrown out, we actually expanded because Manhattan Neighborhood Network, which is a local public access TV station in New York, and the community center we're in right now, the Community Media Center, DCTV, run by John Alpert and Keiko Tsuno, were linked to that movement, and we were able to broadcast in that way, also working with Free Speech TV, Channel 9415 of Dish Network, which is a nonprofit channel on satellite television. We just started to broadcast on public access stations. It's very exciting right now. We're broadcasting on more than 120 stations around the country. We're broadcasting live. Cable stations can take the dish from Dish Network and broadcast the program. And also on the internet and on shortwave radio. And, of course, on community radio stations, NPR stations, and Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. And I really think that we all have to work together. We can't do it alone, none of us. Print, broadcast, internet, if we're going to affect the international national discourse on these issues, we've got to bring all these spaces together. And I think it can make a difference, and I really think it is.
I also think there seems to be, you know, latent common sense, or at least fear among many people in the American public who don't tune in to Democracy Now! Or don't read The Progressive or The Nation. They seem to have an understanding of some of the risks involved in this war that Bush is planning. And so that kind of gives me hope, too. Where does that kind of reservoir of good sense come from, do you think?
I don't think people feel that they should die for oil, or that men and women should go and either be killed or kill for oil. Years ago, during the Persian Gulf War, miraculously enough, I was invited on the Sally Jesse Raphael show. It was quite an amazing moment. Three women for war, three women against the war. All the other women, both for and against, actually, were from the military. Dr. Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn sat next to me, and she was the Army captain doctor who refused to go to the Persian Gulf War, and she was court-martialed. But this was right before she was court-martialed. She was just saying no. She said she was trained to save lives, not take them. And anyway, I was railing against the bombing of Iraq at that time in January of 1991. And railing against the bombing of the cradle of civilization, back to the cradle. And a producer from the Sally Jesse Raphael show called up and said, you want to go on the show? So at first I thought it was a joke, but then Ended up going down a few days later, and we went on the stage, three of us for, three of us against, and the producers who put this together, who wanted Sally to do some serious programming, said, you know, really just get in there and mix it up and make it as exciting as any other show, and we can show that the people in this country want this. And the show started, and Sally went to the audience and said, what do you think? And a woman took the mic and said, I'm afraid of Saddam Hussein's biological weapons. And Dr. Yolanda Hewitt-Vaughn from the stage said, well, I think it's important for you to know that right here in this country we have biological. And before she could finish the words, Sally whirled around. She stormed up to the stage, said, you be quiet, you be quiet, you get out, you get, well, I mean, I hadn't seen this show, I don't even know if Jerry Springer was around then, and I was thinking, my God, I thought she was going to strike Dr. Yolanda Hewitt-Vaughn, and as she came up on the stage, I said, whoa, Sally, back off, and she stopped the taping of that show. The producers came out, they started to cradle her back and forth. They rocked her. It's okay, Sally. It's okay.
She wigged
These
out.
These people are so insulated, they rarely hear this point of view. But anyway, they convinced her to continue with the show. And we got a chance to talk back and forth. And she showed the videotape of the protesters. She said, you know, what's all this about? And I congratulated her for not just showing pictures of protesters that most people don't identify with, but bringing people into the studio to have a civilized discussion. And I said, as the granddaughter of an Orthodox rabbi, it is horrifying for me to see Israeli children with gas masks, but it is more horrifying to see Palestinian children without gas masks. And we had that kind of discussion. It was good. Went home, waited to see the show, and it wasn't being broadcast. I called up, and they said there was a problem with the video. The syncing of the sound, the video and the audio. I said, yeah, I think there was a problem with the sound of our voices. Anyway, I told people not to call us at WBAI to ask, where's the show? Call the Sally Jesse Raphael Show. They were inundated with hundreds of calls. And I had asked to speak to the producer. Could you tell me what's going on here? The executive producer, they said he was a very busy man. And so after they got so many calls, they called up and said, the executive producer wanted to talk to me. I said I was a very busy person. But they eventually ran that show. And it ran with headlines around the country that said things like, things get messy with Sally Jesse. And the most interesting response I got was from women on southern military bases who called up and said, what is this point of view you represent? Because we agree with you. We don't want our loved ones to go to fight for oil or to die for oil. And we thank you in civilian society for having this discussion because we can't have it on military bases. And that's what we have to understand. We have to have this discussion about war and peace, life and death. And we can stop it. We can stop the war.
It was true 12 years ago. It's true today. Well, that's going to have to be all. Amy, thanks so much for being my guest on Progressive Radio, Amy Goodman.
And now, two closing comments.
This one about Bush's State of the Union address, actually. And to me, the address meant that the emperor has spoken. Bush's speech was a despicable exercise in war propaganda. First, he hyped the threat. He invoked Hitlerism, militarism, and communism to set the audience's temperature at the fever line. Though, you know, militarism was an odd triplet, since the United States is father of its own. Bush then gave lurid testimony about Saddam's brutality, which is undeniable, but similar torture techniques are common among allies such as Egypt, Turkey, Pakistan, as well as other nations like Burma. And Bush called Iraq a serious and mounting threat to our country, even though Saddam does not have nuclear weapons, and UN inspectors are busy trying to hunt down any traces of his chemical or biological weapons. Then Bush asserted, without evidence, that Saddam has been aiding and protecting al-Qaeda terrorists. But Bush, who's been trying for months now to glue the beard of Osama bin Laden onto the face of Saddam Hussein, neglected to mention that Saddam and Osama have long despised each other, one being a secular nationalist, the other a theocrat. Plus, this whole idea that Saddam would have a strong incentive to hand off weapons to al-Qaeda is crazy, because if he were detected doing so, and U.S. intelligence is all over Iraq, the United States would destroy him. Bush whisked away the incontrovertible fact that the U.S. deterred Saddam from using chemical and biological weapons against U.S. troops back in 1991. Even the CIA believes he's still deterrable, but Bush responded with this rhetorical flourish. Trusting in the sanity and restraint of Saddam Hussein is not a strategy. It is not an option. Well, that was an applause line to be sure, but wait. Washington trusted in the sanity and restraint of Joseph Stalin, who had weapons of mass destruction, nuclear weapons that could have completely destroyed the United States. Is Saddam crazier and more threatening than Stalin? Not even the hyperbolic Bush could make that claim. But again, he responded with a soundbite. Some have said we must not act until the threat is imminent, he barked. Since when have terrorists announced their intentions politely? Bush is thus expanding his doctrine of preemption to allow for military action almost at any time against any country that may become a threat down the road. This overturns the entire system of international law as well as the UN Charter. No country is allowed to wage war against another country unless it is attacked by that country or just about to be attacked. Neither of these things applies to Saddam Hussein today, and Bush's precedent could lead to world chaos. But he doesn't care much for the opinions of the rest of the world. The course of this nation, he said, does not depend on the decisions of others, and that must have delighted everybody in old Europe. Bush then resorted, as is his wont, to passive voice to suggest that he is some reluctant, peace-loving warrior dragged onto the battlefield. Twice he said, if war is forced upon us. This may be the most obscene use of the passive voice in recorded history. No one is forcing Bush to go to war. He, George W. Bush, is the one who's been forcing the war option from day one. So the emperor has spoken. It is now up to us subjects, no, us citizens, to disobey. And here's one more thing that's on my mind. John Ashcroft's ongoing assault on our civil liberties. As if the USA Patriot Act wasn't bad enough already, Ashcroft and his deputies have been cooking up plans to pass an even harsher successor, Patriot II, the sequel. This beauty would allow the Attorney General and other law enforcement personnel to expand surveillance, authorize secret arrests, justify pretrial detention, and create a DNA database of suspected, not convicted, terrorists, including those who associate with terrorist groups. By the way, failure to provide your DNA would be a felony. The Patriot II would also invalidate agreements that police departments have made with citizens who had successfully sued them for invasion of privacy and other abuses connected with domestic spying in years gone by. The Red Squads would now have a green light again. And the Patriot II would further assail the Freedom of Information Act in two ways. First, it would let the Justice Department refuse requests dealing with suspected terrorists. And second, it would let polluters restrict the distribution of their so-called worst-case scenarios. This material is often crucial for environmentalists to oppose the granting of permits to such companies, but now it would be available only to local residents and only on a read-only basis. Finally, and most ominously, Patriot II would strip people of their U.S. citizenship if they provide material support to a group that the U.S. has designated as a terrorist organization. So if this law had been on the books when I was wearing my button in support of Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress back in the 70s and 80s, I could have been stripped of my citizenship. By now, it should be more than clear that General Ashcroft is a general menace to our basic civil liberties. There is nothing patriotic about the Patriot II. I'm Matt Rothschild. See you next week.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.